Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 40. This is Terry Frost, and in this podcast, we are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Yes, 20 years ago, a couple of weeks ago, the Germanys were reunited and the Soviet Empire began to crumble. The Western world found out how bad a car the Trabant was, and in general, things started changing, and whether they've changed for the better or not is up to debate, and it's not for me to debate it here and now, but I'm celebrating it by showing three Cold War movies set in Berlin, well, at least not showing, but talking about three Cold War movies set in Berlin, and in general, getting into that kind of Cold War Checkpoint Charlie shoot at anybody in the spotlight kind of vibe there. And the movies I'm going to talk about, I'll tell you about in a moment, but I'll let Sal do the intro thing and then we'll get into it. We've got a couple of emails and we'll do the emails and we'll start talking about post-World War II Cold War spy flicks once again.
Paleo Cinema is a three-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode, is paleo-cinema.com. blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.
Okay, how's everybody been? I've been off doing stuff. The weather's warmed up a little bit except for today, and we're heading towards summer here in the Southern Hemisphere. I took Sal out for her birthday. I took her out yesterday for her birthday, and we travelled roughly 600 kilometres. We went up to the New South Wales border to a town called Echuca, had a posh meal, drove through some riverland forests up around the border there, hit a cockatoo with the car, and I should let you know that Toyota Corollas are fantastic if you're going to hit medium-sized birds because you can hit one at 110 kilometres an hour and it doesn't damage the car at all. The bird, on the other hand, did not come off well. It ended up looking like one of those smash budgerigars that cowboys wear in the front of their Stetsons. So that was an interesting day. I did see 2012 as well, the Roland Emmerich disaster flick, the new Irwin Allen of cinema. Very pretty. I mean, the destruction of the Earth was done extremely well. Unfortunately, the script wasn't. So if you wanted to see a bit of disaster porn, head out for that one. Recommended on that level, but if you're looking for something a little bit meatier, you're not going to get it there. It is what it is. It's no better than it has to be. The technicians are the real artists in this case. The only actor that comes out of it looking really good is probably Chiwetel Ejiofor playing one of the scientists who finds out that the world's going to shit, and he seems to kind of make even the dullest of the dialogue sound more or less realistic, and he comes across with no loss of credibility, like a few other people in the film. But I saw that. What else have I been watching? Not a lot that's any good, really. I've been watching Fringe, of course, which is a bit of fun. Sal's been watching Supernatural. I occasionally dip into watching a little bit of that, too. But mostly I've been watching cooking show porn. I'm really sucked in by cooking shows at the moment for some odd reason. And, I want to get a tagine, I want to get an ice cream maker, and I want to get a couple of chefs. But anyway, moving on. Checkpoint Charlie, before the fall of the Berlin Wall. I mean, looking back, it's a weird thing, the Berlin Wall. End of World War II. Three major powers decide they're going to split a city up into two halves. A city that's been there for a very long time. A world centre even before the Nazis were around. And they decided to cut it more or less down the middle and have one half owned by one side of a new burgeoning power struggle and the other half by another side. And in retrospect, this seems a crazy move, but it did bring a certain uniqueness to Berlin that filmmakers fell in love with. And there were a lot of spy movies and a lot of spy novels and short stories and comic books and everything else set in that atmosphere because it's kind of like the knife tip of the Cold War was Berlin. it was the one place where the two sides brushed against each other. And there was a lot of pain and hardship in Berlin at the time. People died trying to get under or across the wall. Families were split right down the middle when the Berlin Wall went up. And it took 30 or 40 years before people could get back together with members of their family. There were husbands and wives separated by this wall, which was suddenly erected. And, of course, that in itself has an innate drama, which cinema found fascinating. But to just get you in the mood for it, I thought I'd leave the emails to the end of the podcast, but just to get you in the mood for the Cold War vibe, I've got a pop song about the Berlin Wall to play, and then I'll get into the three movies I'm going to talk about today. This is, of course, the pop song that you've got to play for anything about the Berlin Wall. It's Miss Tony Fisher and West of the Wall.
West of the Wall!
Ride them like that anymore. Unfortunately, they don't have to. It's really odd. Some of my memories from childhood are of listening to songs like that on the radio when I was a very young kid on my way to school, getting ready in the mornings. You know, the radio was on, and you hear music like that, and it kind of sticks with you a little bit, even though you're half asleep and trying to find where your shoes and your school bag are and all that sort of thing. So not all of my memories are about movies and about TV. There are some of them that are about radio, and I always get a little nostalgic when I listen to that song because it was played a lot in Australian radio at the time. Anyway, moving along, the three movies I'm going to talk about today are, in no particular order, Funeral in Berlin, the Len Deighton-based movie with Michael Caine starring as Harry Palmer. I've talked a little bit about this movie in a previous podcast, but I thought I'd give it a full bore this time around, and it may well be bore. It depends on how interesting it is. But the other two are The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, starring Richard Burton, based on a novel by David Cornwell, also known as Jean Le Carré. And the third and last, and definitely not least of them, is The Quiller Memorandum, a movie directed by Michael Anderson, starring George Segal, Max von Sydow, Alec Guinness, and a few other interesting actors as well. So they're all set in Berlin. They're all set during the Cold War. Two of the three are actually filmed in Berlin, and also two of the three are about the tensions between the USSR and the Soviet bloc and the West, but they're not the same two. Okay, we're going to start off with possibly the least of the three, which is the Harry Palmer one, Funeral in Berlin.
Hello?
Round Robin calling Chaffinch.
Chaffinch, are you receiving me?
What do you want, Chica?
Please observe security procedure.
On a Saturday morning, are you mad?
Bald Eagle wants to see you
urgently at his place.
Look, he's expecting you at 1200 hours.
Tell Ross, I'll be late.
Really work on the insubordinate bit, don't you?
You're useless in the kitchen. Why don't you go back to bed?
Okay, A Funeral in Berlin dates back to 1966, which is one of the prime years for spy movies, as any spy movie fan knows. It's the sequel to the a year before they made The Ypres File, directed by Sidney J. Fury. And like the James Bond films, it was made by the same company, so Cadwick Broccoli and Harry Saltzman produced both the James Bond series and the Harry Palmer series. And the Harry Palmer ones were kind of like an anti-Bond. Everyone was saying these kind of spy movies were anti-Bond. They were the more reality-based, ordinary sort of people spy movies rather than the extraordinary James Bond kind of things. And in a sense, all three of these movies are very much anti-Bond. And there are a couple of conceits in them which kind of emphasise that as well. But the Harry Palmer ones have in common with the Bond films is they're very, very entertaining. They're a lot of fun. Having Michael Caine in there, charismatic as he is, I mean, he proved that earlier in Alfie, the breakthrough film for him, and also Zulu, where he was an upper-class British Army officer. Whatever happened to that guy? What's he doing lately? And actually, his career's been going great for the last, 40-odd years, so he must be doing something right. There was a bit of a lapse in the 70s and 80s for him, but he seems to have come back on that now. Basically, British agent Harry Palmer is sent to Berlin to arrange the defection of Colonel Stock, played by Oscar Homolka. Betrayed by everybody he comes in contact with, Palmer manages to figure out what is going on and escape with his life. That's the précis from Wikipedia, and it pretty much well covers it. Everybody that Harry Palmer comes in contact with in Berlin betrays him, with the possible exception of a very unattractive middle-aged drag queen he meets in a nightclub. So apart from that one person, everybody betrays him, and yet he still manages to persevere. The cast is pretty good in this one too. Apart from Michael Caine, you've got Paul Hubschmidt, a German actor who also starred in a number of other spy movies, playing Johnny Vulcan. Oscar Homolka, as I said, playing Colonel Stock. Oscar Homolka has been in spy movies, well, was in spy movies, he's dead now, but he was in spy movies since at least the 1930s, when he was in Hitchcock's Sabotage. And let's see, Eva Renzi playing Samantha Steele, the love interest in this one. The role was originally going to go to an actress called Anjanette Comer, an American actress, or she might be Canadian, I'm sure. But she came down ill, and so they got Eva Renzi, a German actress, to play the role. Her voice is dubbed by an English actress because her English wasn't quite up to the standards that they required for the film. Of course, we've got the token Australian again, Guy Dolman as Colonel Ross. Hugh Burden as Hallam, the guy who does all the fake passports for the Secret Service. He's got quite an important role in this. And an actor called Gunther Meisner, who you might remember played Slugworth in the first Willy Wonka film. The guy with the Coke bottle glasses, the Germanic-looking guy. Gunther Meisner is in pretty much any spy movie that's got Germans in it. He's in two of these three films. He's also in the second of the films I'm going to talk about today, The Quiller Memorandum. So Gunther Meisner's in there as a familiar face. And this movie really does benefit from the fact that it was filmed on location, apart from various bits of London. It was filmed on location in Berlin, and it shows various Berlin 1960s icons. Like there's in the background in one scene, you'll see Harry Palmer walking into the headquarters of Mercedes-Benz, which has got a great big Mercedes-Benz symbol rotating on the roof. That building also features in the Quiller Memorandum, so it's very much an iconic piece of post-war German architecture there. Not that there was a lot of architecture left after World War II, they had to rebuild a lot of it. And while I'm going to digress a little bit here, but if you manage to get any episodes of the 1950s Flash Gordon, the one done in the early 1950s for television. It was filmed in Germany, and you'll get to see a lot of scenery in post-war Berlin there. And most of it seems to be rubble. There are immense mountains of bricks and things like that, so the whole place was obviously smashed to pieces. And these films coming 20, 21 years after the fall of the Nazi regime and pretty much the wholesale destruction of Berlin. One of the reasons they show various parts of it, I mean, at the start of Funeral in Berlin, they'll show you the modern West Berlin with all the high-rise buildings and the cafes and the restaurants and the stylish women and the Mercedes-Benz motor cars. And then they contrast it in the title sequence with the dim, dark, dour East Germany, just to show the dichotomy between the two, and of course also how much Berlin was rebuilt in that amazing 20 years. So anyway, what do I like about this film? Well, let's start. You got Harry Palmer in there, Michael Caine with his NHS glasses and his working class attitude, and all of these three films do address the class struggle in England, or in Western Europe and in England. Well, let's say in England for all three films. There's an undercurrent of class struggle where the protagonists aren't the sort of people who are on top of the pile, and they are manipulated by the controllers in various ways as spies. It's reflected in the class struggle between them. The bosses are always upper class, and the spies themselves aren't necessarily so. This is less obvious, of course, in James Bond films, where Bond himself is a child of privilege, even though he's an orphan. But it's an interesting thing to watch when you see these films, is to just have that awareness of class difference and how it's reflected in the characters, particularly Harry Palmer and his interactions with Guy Dolman, who's very droll and very funny as Colonel Ross, and mostly also Hugh Burden playing Hallam, the forgery expert for the Secret Service, who has a role in this. Eva Renzi in this film is also really good. She's a fantastically beautiful woman. One of the little bits of trivia about her too was that she actually married Paul Hubschmidt, the guy who plays Palmer's contact in Berlin, Johnny Vulcan. They married after starring together in this film, and the marriage lasted well into the 1970s before they finally split. But the really standout guy who steals scenes left, right and centre wholesale is Oskar Homolka, who, as I said, had been in spy movies since the mid-1930s in Sabotage, the Hitchcock film, which I recommend people see. It's a fantastic piece of cinema. But anyway, I've got some sound bites of Harry Palmer first meeting Colonel Stock, who again turns up in the subsequent film in the series, The Billion Dollar Brain, playing the same character. I just like this. I may have played it on the podcast before, but I'm playing it again because I like it.
Admit I scared you, English. I'm Colonel Stock.
Good afternoon.
I'm sorry about arresting you. Have some tea. It was a simple device to avoid suspicion. As usual, there is no milk today.
And so Russian tea was invented. All right, Colonel Stock, I'm listening.
You are in a hurry. We must get to know each other, English, if we are going to trust each other. I wish to defect, but there are conditions.
What do you want?
I want Colonel's pay for life.
Don't we all?
A house in the country.
Oh, how many bedrooms?
Oh, bedrooms do not matter, but I must have a big garden. I'm a peasant at heart, and I want to grow roses in my old age.
In England, roses are out. Weeds are in. Is that all?
That is all. I want comfort and security.
You've got all that in Russia now.
In Russia, there is no place for an old Bolshevik. In my job, I've made too many enemies.
Well, what about your family?
My wife died in a German air raid in 1941. My only son hasn't written to me in 3 years. What would you do in my position?
I'd stop telling lies for a start. You have no son and your wife is in Kiev with your daughter Katya. I know everything about you, Colonel Stock. From the size of your refrigerator to the cubic capacity of your mistress. You haven't brought me all this way just to tell me a sob story.
Let's stop quarreling, English. Do you play chess?
Yes, but I prefer a game with a better chance of cheating.
I like you, English. You're not as stupid as you look.
Betrayal is a common theme in all three of these films. Everybody, the protagonist in each of these three films that I'm going to talk about is betrayed by the people around him. And I suppose that comes with the milieu of Berlin during the Cold War. It was all about betrayal and the constant tug of war between the two sides and the untrustworthiness of various dealers in stolen and forbidden goods and services. And this is pretty obvious in this film. It's a lot more harshly dealt with in the other two films, but in this one, it's still one of the really big themes that are the engine of the plot. So, Funeral in Berlin. One of these days, I'm going to look at the. Well, I can't really look at the films that were done subsequent to the first Harry Palmer trilogy because they all date from the 1990s, and that's not really what we do here, so I'm not going to touch those ones, but I do recommend you see all five of them. I don't think they're quite up to the standard of the first three, but they're interesting and they're worth watching. So that's it. Funeral in Berlin, the climax is pretty interesting too, where everybody is kind of trying to kill Harry Palmer, but through manipulation and luck and what is known in the spy industry as his tradecraft, a quality that Harry Palmer as a character also shares very strongly with Quiller, the character played by George Segal in the Quiller Memorandum. His tradecraft is the thing that helps him survive, and the fact that, in spite of the fact he's betrayed, he's knowledgeable enough in what he does to realise that the betrayals aren't to be taken personally in a sense. They're part of the deal. They're part of what's going on there. They're part of doing business in that particular time and place. The movie is very competently directed by Guy Hamilton, who also directed a couple of the early Bond films. So while they're stylistically not like Bond in any way, that commonality of the director, having Guy Hamilton be the director, gives them that same kind of 60s ambience, even though, of course, the James Bond films have a kind of hyper-reality about them. They might be on location, they might be set in certain times and places, but it's kind of ramped up. The colours are brighter, the girls are more beautiful. Bond is a world of on its own, whereas the Harry Palmer films are set into a world that already exists. But Funeral in Berlin, you know, there are no bad films in the three Harry Palmer movies, but it stands alongside The Oppressed Father as the two better ones of the thing, even though the craziness of Ken Russell's billion-dollar brain is definitely worth watching. The first two stand best as spy films of the three. In a moment, I'm going to talk about the second of the three films, The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, starring Richard Burton.
There is a moving searchlight beamed onto the wall where you are to climb. Now, your signal to go will be when the beam stops. As you near the wall, they will move the searchlight off that area to conceal you from outside observation by other detachments.
Haven't the flanking detachments been briefed?
No, only the guard in this sector. It would be too dangerous to arouse too much curiosity.
The Spy Who Came In From the Cold was the first adaptation of a John le Carré novel. It's a 1965 film. It was adapted by Paul Dane, one of the a screenwriter who also did a lot of the scripts for the Planet of the Apes movies, oddly enough. It stars Richard Burton as Alec Lemus, Claire Bloom, Oscar Werner, Peter Van Eyck, Sam Wanamaker, Rupert Davies and Cyril Cusack. It was directed by Martin Ritt, who didn't do a hell of a lot of movies, but some of the movies he did were pretty memorable. I'll just go into the list here. Hud with Paul Newman in 1963, The Outrage, which is an adaptation of Rashomon in 1964. He did Ombre again with Paul Newman, The Brotherhood, The Great White Hope, The Molly Maguires, Norma Rae, which is a film I didn't particularly like. And he did the movie with Barbara Streisand, Nut, in 1987. This film is probably the bleakest of the 1960s. Spy movies in a lot of senses, and I'll just go through a bit of the plot and then go into the reasons why. The West Berlin office of the Circus under administrator Alex Lemus has not been doing well. In fact, he's recalled to London shortly after the death of one of his operatives. Lemus is seemingly demoted to the banking section of the agency. In reality, this is a carefully staged transformation of Lemus. Now depressed and disgruntled, he's quickly spotted by the East German intelligence service as a potential defector. He's basically faking being a disillusioned ex-intelligence officer. Lemus accepts overtures from German communists to reveal British secrets and payments, and he's interviewed in Holland about what he knows. When the process is later moved to East Berlin, the interviews become less cordial. It appears Lemus has information that will implicate a powerful East German intelligence officer named Mundt as a paid informant of the British. But the information is spotty and it frustrates his interrogator, Herr Fiedler, played by Oskar Werner. When Mundt arrives at the compound and discovers the investigation, he has both Lemus and Fiedler arrested. Mundt is eventually arrested himself. That's basically part of the plot line, but the other aspects of it as well is part of Lemus's cover is that he takes a job in a parapsychology library where he meets a woman played by Claire Bloom, who had worked with Martin Ritt in Outrage. She plays a fellow librarian there with whom he falls in love. She's also an ardent communist, which of course it brings up the tension between the two characters, because Lemus, being an undercover agent of the West, and he falls in love with a woman whose sympathies aren't necessarily where his own are. And both of the actors are fantastic in this. They do bring a certain reality to the roles and to the rapport the two have. They're both essentially very lonely people, and they get together, and Lemus's cover as an alcoholic, disgruntled, surly, nasty character leads him to do some things which I think, from my reading of the film, make him disgusted with himself. As with the first of these films, it's a very much an anti-Bond film. In fact, one of the degrees to which it is anti-James Bond is that Lemus goes to jail for a short time for beating up a shopkeeper who is played by Bernard Lee, who played M in the early James Bond films. So Alec Lemus goes to jail basically for beating up James Bond's boss. Again, it's one of those little cute bits that the movie buffs will see in a film that other people may not particularly pick up on. But it's filmed very much in black and white. It shows not only the disillusionment and the nastiness and the cynicism and the ugliness of intelligence work, but it also shows the poverty of post-war England. In 1965, I mean, the pay rates were horrible. People, to earn a living, basically had to scrimp and save and put things on credit at the greengrocers and all sorts of things like that, which kind of, again, made this a weird combination of intelligence movie, and it's got not a little bit in common with the Angry Young Men flicks of the 1950s and 1960s. A lot of the film is set in not too salubrious parts of London. And Lemus living in a small rented place while he is establishing his cover as a disgruntled ex-intelligence officer. His control officer, who's known as Control, is played by Cyril Cusack, who's a fantastic actor and plays the upper-class, disaffected and basically nasty bastard that Control is very well. He's oily and a thoroughly repugnant character, as indeed is Rupert Davies, who plays a character that appears later in a miniseries based on a John le Carré novel, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, where the character is played by Alex Guinness, and of course I'm talking about George Smiley. Smiley's a minor character in this, played by Rupert Davies, and he is a liaison between Control and Lemus, while Lemus is undercover, and that liaison between the two when they meet is part of the unravelling of the plot. As part of the plan is for him to have the meeting with Lemus so that parts of Lemus's cover are blown to enable certain misinformation to be given to the other side. The film is tragic in the end. It doesn't end well for pretty much either of the protagonists. I won't give away too much on that, but don't expect an upbeat Hollywood kind of ending to this film. It's bleak and it's dark, and it's very much a film that shows the Cold War, Cold Warriors, as not necessarily being the best kind of person. They're not necessarily James Bond. And in fact, there's a little speech that Richard Burton gives towards the end of the film, which pretty much covers this off and gives the grounding for Le Carré's approach to spy fiction. And John Le Carré, under his real name David Cornwell, was an intelligence officer in the 1950s and early 1960s. So he pretty much knows of what he speaks. I'll just play that soundbite from towards the end of the film where Lemus is unburdening himself to his girlfriend Nan Perry, played by Claire Bloom, on the nature of his work and the nature of the intelligence apparatus as it existed at the time.
What the hell do you think spies are? Moral philosophers measuring everything they do against the word of God or Karl Marx? They're not. They're just a bunch of seedy, squalid bastards like me. Little men, drunkards, queers, henpecked husbands, civil servants playing cowboys and Indians to brighten their rotten little lives. Do you think they sit like monks in a cell, balancing right against wrong? Yesterday I would have killed Mundt, because I thought him evil and an enemy, but not today. Today he's evil and my friend. London needs him. They need him so that the great moronic masses you admire so much can sleep soundly in their flea-bitten beds again. They need him for the safety of ordinary, crummy people like you and me.
You killed Fiedler!
How big does a cause have to be before you kill your friends? What about your party? There's a few million bodies on that path.
Richard Burton is excellent in this film, and I think that his relationship with Elizabeth Taylor kind of has overwhelmed the memory of Richard Burton as an actor. Yes, he was very theatrical in a lot of ways, but I think that that's kind of worked in his favour in retrospect. If you look over the body of his work from between the 1950s when he did things like Look Back in Anger right up until his last film, 1984, you'll see that even though he has had a tendency to overact, and of course he did have problems with alcohol, he's a striking actor and an intelligent actor, and he always had that fantastic sense of menace and vulnerability both. Even in when films when he wasn't playing particularly a menacing character, there was always that kind of subtext of menace there. And one of the reasons why I like Richard Burton, and this is a silly reason, and I'll be upfront about that, is that he actually is a distant relative of mine. He's my mother's second cousin. So that kind of adds to it all. But leaving that aside, I think that Burton in this is great. There are some other smaller roles which are good. Claire Bloom is excellent as Nan, his girlfriend. Oscar Werner, I always find interesting. Sam Wanamaker as Peters, one of the guys from the other side who interrogates him, is fantastic. And there's a small piece by Michael Horden, an English character actor that a lot of people know from many, many movies, as Ash, one of the circus's intelligence agents, who is pretty overtly homosexual and basically very attracted to Lemus. And there are some tensions between the two of them in a strip club in Soho, where they also meet Dick Carlton, played by Robert Hardy, who's another one of the intelligence officers. But it's a great dramatic film, this one. It's interesting, and the characters and the scenes and the plot and the script carry you along with it right to the ending on the Berlin Wall itself, which is pretty memorable. I've only seen this movie twice. I saw it most recently a week ago, and the previous time I saw it was, it'd have to be the 1970s on television, and the ending still stayed with me from that. And there aren't a lot of movies that are that striking and memorable. It's really an extraordinary film that you can retain a memory of for nearly 40 years. Definitely recommend it. It's a little bit difficult to find, but you can find it through the usual subterranean sources. You've got to be a little bit of an intelligence officer yourself sometimes to find these films. But it is out there, and it's definitely worth having a look at and just kind of comparing it with the other spy movies of the day. It's very much a much more serious work, but it's all part of that pantheon of 1960s spies in cinema who I find very interesting. I mean, a big spy movie buff, of course, so it's very much in my sort of thing. But that's about it for Spy Who Came In From the Cold. If you haven't seen it, definitely do so. And ultimately, the script is written by somebody who knew of what they spoke, so it wasn't just written by a script writer beside a kidney-shaped swimming pool in Hollywood. Is written by somebody who indeed had been on the front line of that particular Cold War. another little bit of a sting and a break, and I'll be back with a third of the movie's Aquila Memorandum.
Aquila Memorandum, adapted for the screen from Adam Hall's world bestseller, is now a taut and tensely exciting thriller. America's George Segal as Quiller, Britain's Alec Guinness as Pole, Sweden's Max von Sydow.
My name's October.
October, a name to match the man.
You need to relax.
Cold.
May work you too hard.
Bleak.
That boss of yours, what's his name?
Terrifying.
Open your eyes.
Begin your eyes, Quiller. Can you hear me? Begin it!
Austria's Senta Berger as Inge. She's very beautiful, very loving. Very, very afraid. With George Saunders as Gibbs.
Any news from Berlin?
Australia's Robert Helpman as Wang. Stop. Go.
Move over, please.
It's a cat and rat game in the human jungle.
If you're still undecided by dawn, we will kill you both.
What do they want of Quilla? What does Quilla want of them? Answer is in the Quiller Memorandum.
Okie doke. The Quiller Memorandum is a 1966 film based on a novel by Trevor Dudley Smith using his pseudonym of Adam Hall. He was one of those writers who had a number of different pseudonyms. He also wrote the, writing as Elston Trevor, he wrote the adventure story that became the movie The Flight of the Phoenix, so the guy's definitely got the chops there. The original books were about a British secret agent called Quiller, not an American one played by George, as it played by George Segal in this movie. I'll just go through a little bit of the plot synopsis for you, and I'll talk about the other actors in there. Okay, in the dead of night, a man walks down a deserted Berlin street. He enters a phone booth, but as he dials a number, he is quietly killed by an unseen sniper. Jones was the second British Secret Intelligence Service operative to be murdered in Berlin by a secret neo-Nazi organisation, Phoenix. SIS sends Quiller George Segal to Berlin. And I'm rather than do the rest of the plot pre-see, I'm going to let Alec Guinness do it because there's a little bit of a plot synopsis that he gives while he's briefing Quiller inside the Olympic Stadium from the 1936 Olympics, where, of course, Jesse Owens beat the shit out of the Nazi runners. One of the things I want you to listen to in this is the dialogue. The screenplay was written by Harold Pinter, the well-known playwright Harold Pinter. And the dialogue has that kind of clipped sentences and terseness and that subtext of other meaning that is one of the hallmarks of Pinter's work. And it's to have that in a spy movie rather than in a stage play or something along those lines is an interesting departure. It makes this movie very much different. So I'm going to play Paul, played by Alec Guinness, briefing Quiller. Just listen for the tone of the dialogue and the way that everything is short sentences and it's very terse. And even though it does seem very banal in the way they're speaking, there is a hidden meaning below the obvious text of what they're saying.
Ever been here before?
No.
Impressive, isn't it? Built by Werner in 1936 for the Olympics. It holds 100,000 people. Certain well-known personalities used to stand right up there. Must have been quite noisy. 100,000 people all cheering, wouldn't you say? Yes, quite noisy. Some Leberwurst?
No, thanks.
Or some Schinken? Oh, wait a moment. What am I talking about? This isn't Schinken. It's Knackwurst. What about some Knackwurst?
I'm not hungry.
Aren't you? Oh, I am. Oh, you won't mind if I eat while we walk?
What do you want?
You've been on holiday, I understand.
I am on holiday.
By the sea.
What do you want?
Oh, my name's Paul, by the way.
What?
P-O-L. Paul.
Mine's Quiller.
Oh, I know that. I'm told you've been working in the Middle East for some time.
Yes, I've been working there.
We've been engaged in some rather tough work here. Oh, I think we're coping moderately well with the situation in other parts of the country, but it's getting a bit out of hand in Berlin. Quite a tough bunch. Nazi from top to toe. In the classic tradition. But not just the remains of the old lot, oh no. There's quite a bit of new blood. Youth. Firm believers, very dangerous. It wouldn't do to underestimate them. Oh, quite complex, of course. The overall, difficult to pinpoint. Nobody wears a brown shirt now, you see. No banners. Consequently, they're difficult to recognize. They look like everybody else. They move in various walks of life, but they are very careful and quite clever. And they look like everybody else. Intriguing, don't you think? Oh, however, I agree with you. I mean, that's all politics, not our job. I'll tell you what our job is. Our job is to get to the hard core, the extreme element. The ones you can recognize if you get close enough to see them. They have a base here, but we don't know where it is. We need, rather urgently, to find it.
I've read the files.
You read them while you were in London, did you?
That's right.
Who was our leading operator here in the last file you saw?
Metzler.
He's dead. Another colleague of yours took over from him. Kenneth Lindsay Jones.
Mm-hmm.
He's dead, too. He was killed 2 days ago. Long range, 9.3, in the spine. We'd like you to take over. Oh, he was obstinate. He refused cover. If he'd allowed us to give him cover, he might not be dead, and we might have a better idea of how far he'd got.
He was justified in using any method he thought fit.
Not a very efficient method in his case.
What do you know about it? You only talk to people.
This is a very strong operation, fully urgent. They've killed two of our men. We want you to take over from Jones. Oh, I've been asked to say that this is not an order, but a request. Consider it, will you? At your leisure. I'll give you 5 minutes. Perhaps you'll join me in Section E at 11:26.
Do you see what I mean about the dialogue? The crispness of it, the sense of menace below it. It makes this film a wonderful thing. It's not paced the way a spy thriller normally is paced. It's got a slow, leisurely rhythm to it. The choice of George Segal as the actor to play Quiller is a bit of an unusual one, but I think it works in context. Segal had just finished making Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with Richard Burton, who was in the last spy movie we talked about. He had a lot of credibility as an actor. He was working in Europe at the time, and in this case, he does a pretty good job because he is very much a fish out of water. He's not the usual run of the mill. He's the only American in the film. There's Paul, who's kind of weirdly upper-class British, but maybe has a slightly foreign background. There are a couple of scenes where the spy masters, one of whom is played by George Sanders, discuss in very abstract terms what's going on in Berlin while sitting around their gentleman's club eating pheasant and rare roast beef and things like that. So obviously Harold Pinter had a little bit to say about the English class system in this film as well. And they speak of it in such abstract terms that you can't really tell what's going on based on the dialogue of the spy master. They just know there's this business in Berlin and it's being taken care of without speaking very specifically about it. And the dialogue's almost comedic in the sense of that abstraction to it. But the other actors in the film are fantastic. Senta Berger is incredibly beautiful in this film. The camera loves her, and she's filmed in soft focus a couple of times in a way that kind of reminded me of the way that Ingrid Bergman was filmed in Casablanca with that kind of loving lens. And she's very effective in this film. Max von Sydow is terrific as October, the neo-Nazi Reichsfuhrer. He is weird and dangerous and intelligent and a very formidable opponent for Quiller. There's a scene of interrogation where Quiller's drugged with some kind of truth serum drug and October is interrogating him. And as Quiller responds in a kind of drugged out, abstracted way, October just seizes on it and tries to steer him to giving out the information by using what Quiller's saying against him and drawing out more information from it. It's quite an effective scene. It's well filmed, and the dialogue, of course, being Pinter, carries the story incredibly well. The movie was directed by Michael Anderson, a director who did, among other things, I think, Logan's Run, and a lot lesser work. He's a very much a journeyman director, but nonetheless, in this film, with the settings in Berlin and the actors that he has to work with, and of course the screenplay he's got to work with, it'd be really hard to stuff this one up. It's a very effective film. I mean, the other people I've known haven't liked it as much as I have, but I do. I think the music by John Barry, which uses a lot of, sounds like reindeer bells or something like that in it, is pretty interesting. There are a few little bits of music which are very much reminiscent of some of the stuff he did in movies like Thunderball. So there's that John Barry feel about the music at times, which can take you out of the movie just very slightly. But nonetheless, the actors, including, I've got to mention, Robert Helpman, the Australian actor playing one of Paul's associates. Robert Helpman having his kind of evil, elfish face. He played the child snatcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, you might recall, and had a long and distinguished career, both as a dancer and as an actor, in Europe and in Australia. And one of the reasons I love Robert Helpman is, in the 1960s, he did a surf song called Surfer Doll. He was like in his late 50s, early 60s, and he did basically a Beach Boy-style surfing song as a bit of a piss take. And I'll see if I can find it and play it in a future podcast. Maybe I'll try to find it for one of the music podcasts. But anyway, the film really works well. I like it as a spy movie because I think the location shooting is used very intelligently. And there are things like in the background in one scene, there's a sign that says Burger Killer. To show the kind of, there's a very strong strain of the Americanization of West Germany in this film. There's a scene set in a bowling alley where there's a kind of German pop version of Petula Clark's Downtown playing in the background. So you've got that kind of pan-European Eurovision sort of feel to the movie. And again, the 20 years after the war kind of rebuilding West Germany feel of the thing makes it an interesting spy movie for that reason. Unlike the other two, this one doesn't reference communism at all. It's purely about neo-Nazis in West Germany and how they may be undermining from the other direction the powers that existed at the time in that country. So it's slightly different for that, but not bad for it. I mean, the setting really works, and Max von Sydow as the menacing October is one of the really good spy movie baddies of the 1960s. The only one that I can compare him to is later on. I like Klaus Maria Braundauer in Never Say Never Again in 1983. I think he's got that kind of Euro-trash sinisterness that I find very interesting. And there are a few character traits with October as well. Things like when he's interrogating Quiller, he's always popping his knuckles and things like that in a very kind of grinding and annoying way. And when the second time Quiller meets him, he's actually practicing his golf swing indoors with a kind of plastic golf ball thing. So there are these little bits of business that show more of the character than the actual script and the setting allows. Yeah, and ultimately, again, as in the other two films, there's a deep betrayal in several points for Quiller, not necessarily by his handlers, his spy masters, but by other characters in the movie. So all three of these films is about betrayal of the most honest man in the film, in a sense. And that makes for a very interesting viewing. And the script understates the betrayal in a very interesting way. It's never spoken of, really. The dialogue's about, not even about the betrayal. The dialogue's very banal at the ending with the betrayals that occur. And Pinter's script keeps it in the background, makes it very, very obvious what's happening. I'm not going to do a spoiler on that, but if you see the film, you'll know what I mean. It's an incredibly interesting movie because of that obliqueness, because of the Harold Pinter script, and because the actors, knowing that Pinter is who Pinter is, actually have to stretch themselves and find ways to make the dialogue subtext apparent. And for that, it's a very, very unusual spy movie. And, of course, there was a glut of spy movies in 1966, and to have one stand out like this one is quite an achievement. that's about it for the Quiller Memorandum. Definitely see it if you get a chance. It has turned up on TCM a couple of times here in Australia, which obviously means it will do so overseas, and highly recommend it, which is what I say about every movie I do, but what the hell, I'm who I am, and I'm just going to have to accept that. But I'll just have another break, and then we'll have a chat about the letter I got. I only got one, so you guys have been remiss. But I have got some Twitter feedback, which I do appreciate, but it's not really in a format that lends itself well to repeating on the podcast. I do appreciate all that feedback, and I'll respond to it individually, but the emails are the thing that I'll read out for the podcast. So I'm going to leave you next with another track by Tony Fisher. In this case, it's a song which was also recorded by Scott Walker and Del Shannon and a few other people. It's called The Big Hurt. Okay, I got a very nice email from a guy called Mark Richardson. Mark says, "Hi, Terry, just a quick email to say that I love your Paleo Cinema podcast. I started listening about a month ago when I decided to start engaging the brain a bit more with my iPod by downloading some podcasts instead of just music. Your podcast was actually the first podcast I ever listened to, and now I subscribe to many others. So you quite successfully sold me on the format. I live in London and most often find myself listening to your show whilst waiting to go to see films in some of the more charismatic picture houses in the city. I enjoy spending my autumn evenings wandering around Trafalgar Square in the cold and the dark, listening to your recollections on cinema. I also find that my DVD rental list is quickly resembling a rundown of films discussed on your podcast. Finally, perhaps you might consider doing a show on films in which therapy or psychoanalysis play a part. I'm training to be a psychoanalyst, and I want to believe that there's more interesting cinematic representations of the couch out there than just Woody Allen. All the best, Mark Richardson." Thanks, Mark. This is what it's all about, getting people to share the love of movies. So if you've got any movies you want to recommend to people, drop an email and we'll put it on the podcast. Very happy to do so. And I like the idea of people walking around what are, for me, exotic locations, listening to the podcast and enjoying what I do and, of course, enjoying what I share as far as my passion for the cinema is. As far as doing some films on therapy or psychoanalysis, I started kind of getting a list together on that. I think, is it Spellbound, the Hitchcock one, with where the hero is a female psychiatrist of some kind? I'm going to have to do some research on that, but it's a good idea. and it's definitely one that I'll try to do at some stage. At the moment, I've got the next couple of podcasts lined up. I'm looking at doing a bit about Samuel Fuller and another bit about Warren Oates. So they're the next couple that I'm going to bring out. But definitely like the suggestion, and I'm definitely going to see what I can find. If other people can recommend any movies that I might want to add to the podcast that have a theme of therapy or psychoanalysis in it, apart from, of course, Battlefield Earth, and we all know that the Scientologists hate psychiatrists, so in psychiatry. But anyway, thank you for that, Mark. I'm really happy that you enjoyed what I do, and you've given me a new direction to go in, so that's fantastic too. Anyway, that's about it for this podcast. Time for me to go away and enjoy the nice weather. The rain stopped now. We had some torrential rain after some very high temperatures, but that seems to have stopped, and we're heading into the Christmas party season, which I always enjoy. And I'm kind of gearing up towards the annual Newton Mass podcast, so I'm not sure what I'm going to do for that, but I'm trying to find something different and something wild and wacky and a bit memorable for that. I might even get Sal to come and do a Newton Mass wish for everybody if I can get her away from her Nintendo DSi. Anyway, that's about it. Enjoy your movie viewing. Don't forget to drop the emails. I need a few more. I need something to talk about besides what I'm watching in the movies. So kultgru@gmail.com. And I will be back doing this again in 3 weeks' time. I want to get at least two more shows in before the reindeer hit the roof. And I'm not sure how the schedule is for that, but I'm going to make it work. Anyway, I'll catch you guys later.